Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 673. Katie wants on the Nerdist Community Corkboard by emailing events at nerdist.com.
Well, first, there is a... If you live in Pittsburgh and
you're... You know I don't.
And well, there's some maybe some people that do.
I'm sorry. I just focus on myself.
And they are in the comedy and want to be... Or maybe they want to start comedy. Yep. I don't know. Or they want to go to an open mic. There's an open mic called Comedy Sauce every Monday at 9 p.m. at the Pleasure Bar in Bloomfield, which is, I guess, near Pittsburgh. I don't know. I don't know the exact geography of Pennsylvania, but they say Bloomfield within Pittsburgh.
Okay. So, well, next week when we come back, we're going to do a geography test, and I want you to tell me every major region of Pennsylvania.
But it sounds fun, and it sounds like if you're getting into comedy and live in Pittsburgh, you should go check that out.
Fantastic.
Also, one of our listeners named Zoe, there is no last name, she runs a sports speaker series across North America. That is, it's like TED Talks, but it's all about baseball. Jonah Carey has been on it, and some upcoming events are in New York City on May 27th and June 8th, and you can find more information at pitchtalksbaseball.com. But it sounds really cool. It sounds like if you're into baseball and you're into kind of like, you know, all the minutia of baseball, you would really enjoy this.
Matt Myra should do that.
He would love it, yeah.
Go talk about it.
Yeah, that's it. So that's what we got for today.
Do you want to promote anything of your own?
Listen to the podcast. We have Pro You with Tom, which has been doing great.
Tom
we
J.
have,
Dieters.
You know, Ding Donger with Matt Bronger, The Kale. And we have so many other shows. Just go to Nerdist.com and click podcast to find them all.
You're a busy lady.
Yep.
Katie producing the shit out of all this quality digital audio entertainment. You're sort of the Duchess of comedy podcasting. I think the podcasting would largely not exist if you did not exist. If you were in like a It's a Wonderful Life, mm-hmm. and you were like, Clarence, I wish I was never born. So many podcasts.
There would be no podcasts.
There would be almost no podcasts. So just know that when you go to bed at night, you're important.
Thank you.
All right, good. I'm glad you feel better about it. This episode is Matthew Weiner, who created a show called Mad Men. That's now on Sunday nights at 10 p.m. on AMC, which is in its final...
Oh, it's almost done. Yeah, it's weird.
It is weird. That show's been on for like 8 years.
I know.
8.
If you watch older episodes, it's so weird to see how they've all grown. It's so interesting.
Yeah,
they all
I know.
Look so different.
8 years is a long time.
Yeah.
And I'm excited to see what he does next.
Yeah. I always like when he's on because we talk about The Sopranos, which is my favorite show of all time.
You get a little behind the curtain.
I was asking him all these questions.
But, you know, Matt's an incredibly insightful guy and great with information about stuff that you love. And also just about how to, you know, if you are an artist of any type, preferably a writer in this case, there's a lot of information to be gleaned from listening to Matt talk. So
definitely.
Here's the Nerdist Podcast number 673 with Matthew Weiner.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
How
are
you doing?
I'm so sorry.
I can't believe you have any kind of health issues. You only have 9 shows.
I know. Well, it's chiropractic.
Does it work?
Yes, I have an amazing chiropractor. It's just the bad part is that he is in Altadena, which is like the north edge of Pasadena.
Oh, I know where it is.
And so
it's beautiful.
It's nice, but it's far. And I was traveling doing stand-up all weekend, and I'm just like, I'm sitting on planes and carrying bags, and I came back all twisted up, so I had to sneak over. And
you have a good pillow?
A travel pillow?
No, pillow. You travel with a pillow?
No, but some people do.
A lot of comics do, actually.
No, I don't. I do have a good pillow.
I thought that was sanitary or something. I didn't know it was actually...
I don't know. I think some people just like a pillow like a security. It's a security pillow for some people, where they just like to have their own pillow.
My grandmother had her own.
Did she carry? She took it over.
It had a satin pillowcase on it because for her hair.
Did that help keep the hair in place?
The hairstyle from getting messed up.
Really?
It's so slippery or something.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, you can still buy them.
Satin
we put them on the show. Yeah.
My grandfather had satin sheets that were.
What did he do?
He, my grandfather, my mom's dad ran a couple bowling centers in Miami.
Oh, right. We talked about this. Yeah. Right.
And so
I totally forgot that.
Yeah. And he had, and then, because in the
80s. So he wore satin all the time, probably. Right? Satin jacket.
He did not wear a satin jacket, but he was a pretty hip, modern kind of a guy. And in the 80s, like, he had a swinging bachelor pad that,
you know,
like satin sheets and modern art on the walls. Like, he was one of those guys.
It definitely has a sex vibe, but my grandmother's was not. It was purple or like pink, and it never went with the sheets. The rest of the sheets weren't like it. It was her pillow for her hairdo.
Her very own hairdo.
We were seeing all of these things, and I had women like tell it to me anecdotally that they would, because they get your, it costs money to get your hair done.
Mm-hmm.
And they would only do it once a week, and then by the end of the week, it would be, you know, you'd have to go get it done again. But they would not shower. They'd wear bathing caps, things
right.
like that. Maybe they'd do like a curling iron to spruce it up a little bit, hairspray, try and get it where it was. But most of the time, they would frequently wrap it in toilet paper.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Before they went to sleep to sort of have it keep its shape.
That's unbelievable. Because I was just... Oh, really?
Still do it?
Yeah.
Wrap it in toilet paper.
Yeah.
Well, the person who's opening for me on the road is a comic named April Richardson, and it's one of my best friends, and we were really funny too. But as we were walking through the airport, and we saw a lady in her mid-50s that had the standard super short mom haircut, and she's like, I hope I never get the mom haircut. And I go, yeah, but listen, you know, you probably get to a certain point where you just want a utilitarian. I mean, it doesn't look bad.
Part of it
but
is.
But cutting all the hair off is like you don't have to deal with it.
Somewhere along the lines, they told women, first of all, there's a bunch of movie stars that have it and they look amazing. And
yeah.
So you think you're going to look amazing. Second of all, they tell women that that long hair is for young people. And when you get to be a certain age, if your hair is still long, that you basically look like you're trying to look young.
Really?
Yes. This is I'm positive of this.
Okay, okay.
And I don't think that it's true necessarily. And then every once in a while, there's some woman who's like goes prematurely gray at like 30 and is like, I don't know why people don't like gray hair. And like they look amazing. And it's this like weird sex thing actually. Like they're wearing a white wig, right? They look like Seika.
Yeah. Yep.
And then they're so you never know what it is. But I think that Joey Heatherton, like short, you know, there's a whole bunch of Goldie Hawn had it in the 60s. And it was that pixie thing or whatever. And I think that they think it's going to make them look youthful in some way. But I don't know if your hair, like, you know, you get older, your hair, like, if you know, if you're a woman, your hair gets thinner.
Right.
And this is the whole beautiful thing is that a woman can wear a wig. Like anytime they want to, and it's not, there's nothing wrong with it, but they don't do it.
You know, we
but
should bring back guy wigs.
I agree with
like,
you.
Like Mozart you know, style guy, like Mozart style guy wigs, like giant powdered wigs.
In the National Gallery, there was a painting of Washington, George Washington, which is like a famous painting of him because it's the only one where he was painted without his wig on. And he looks like, what did he look like?
Katie, find that picture.
It's pretty amazing, actually. He looks.
So Washington
looks like somebody famous, believe it or not, without the whole.
He went raw dog on the hair.
Yeah, he's not complete. You know what? He looks a little bit like Joe Biden.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's just kind of like he's very. It's gray.
Yeah,
and it's thin. So, but it's kind of hard. Maybe like if Steve Martin was like bald, like kind of like that, like a little.
Was it kind of receding and thinning? And
oh,
stuff?
It's super receding and thinning. Obviously, that's why he wore it's not the only. They all wore wigs all the time. This, yeah.
Oh, wow. That's crazy. Yeah, of course. It's
doesn't he? Who's he look like?
He looks a little like,
he's got a doughy face.
It looks like he could be a Baldwin.
That's amazing. That is very
he
good.
He looks a little like he could be a Baldwin, you know, like.
I think he looks like.
George Baldwin.
Yeah. We had a Naked Truth episode that I did. When I was on that show where that was the forgotten Baldwin brother. It was played by John Hawke, actually. Do you know that actor?
No.
Yeah, you do know. You know this guy.
Okay.
Yeah. He was in Marcy May, Martha Marlene or
okay.
whatever.
And that was the Naked Truth. Was that Tay Leone?
Tay Leone, yeah. And he played Dwayne Baldwin, who was the extra Baldwin brother.
That's who Washington looks like. That's so crazy.
Yeah.
But it's... Yeah, because we have these images of these people of just like you see them on a dollar bill and you're like, oh, that's what they look like.
Well,
no, that was some prep.
But you know what? That was a very naturalistic time in art. Even the, you know, a little bit after that, they start doing them as like Roman senators and they, right. like, you know, and you get, but it was a time when there's like a lot of detail in it and you get a feeling that that's really what they look like. Some of these paintings, like they're pretty consistent. Ben Franklin, you pretty much know what Ben Franklin looked like.
Oh, yeah.
He really did look, well, I mean, because there are times when everybody's sort of idealized, like Julius Caesar, you don't really have a good sense of what he looked like, even though there's so many statues of him.
Yeah.
The weird thing to me about the hair thing, just to get back to this, is we had some conversation about, obviously because of the show, about facial hair. And I always associate it with, you know, if you're getting on the facial hair bandwagon, like it always is being determined by young people.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a character like Robert Morse who had that goatee and the mustache. And like that's very much of his period. And we sort of like have attitudes about it. And I was talking about these giant, the hipster beards, like who's going to like, what's that going to look like when those guys get old?
Yeah.
Old people one day will once again, and prospectors will once again be wearing those beards, right? Is it a way of suggesting that you're so handsome that you can wear this hideous beard? And then you look at something like the Civil War and you see that the president, like Lincoln has really long hair.
Yeah.
General Custer has shoulder length hair.
Yeah.
The beards, the mutton chops, it has nothing to do with people's weight or anything like that. Everybody's got this long, like female hair. Like how does that come in and go out? How does that, you know what I mean?
I don't know. I think it's generational. I think like the generation after that's like, that's what our parents did. So then they do the opposite. You know?
You just think about employment prospects. Sure. Do they really do the opposite?
I think they do. It's like if your parents are conservative, you probably grow your hair out. If your parents are hippies, yeah. then maybe you're, you know, maybe you're a little, there's a really great side-by-side comparison of Lincoln. It was at the beginning of his presidency and at the end of the Civil War.
Pictures, they look terrible.
And in the beginning, he looks really cool. And right. at the end, it just looks like
yeah.
someone just dragged him behind.
Have you seen the pictures of Obama?
No, side by side, no.
Oh, they've done it with all the presidents that they have photographs of, probably starting with Lincoln. And they look terrible. You should see what JFK looks like 3 years into that. And I mean, obviously he was killed, but before
right.
that.
He looked really bad after that.
He looked
that.
Terrible yeah. in those photos after yeah. he was assassinated.
He really needed a wig after that. Oh, come God. On, guys. What? Oh. What? You didn't know him? It was a long time ago, Kyle. Come on. What are we
yeah.
doing?
I mean, I have to be careful.
Really sorry about that.
I'm not in the writer's room. Every once in a while, somebody gets caught in real life talking the way they do when they're in the writer's room.
Oh, yeah,
and it's just horrible. You just like sort of say like,
yeah, there's a certain context in a writer's room.
I know. Look at Al Franken, you know, has to like live down like the amazing comedy bits that he wrote. Like, you know,
yeah.
what is Anne Frank getting for Christmas? You remember, you know, that joke? Like, what is the worst thing to get her is a drum set.
Yeah.
You know, there was like that. He had to like live all that down to go and become a politician.
Of course.
You know,
I just think it's funny that, you know, now it's
recant in a way of stuff that's legitimately funny, but completely inappropriate.
Yeah. Comedy does not really translate to any other type of work where you can,
I don't know what the difference is between our public conversation. I mean, it's Stalinist right now. The public conversation is so limited and there's so much outrage and there's so much policing and monitoring. And the ironic thing is, it reminds me of when I was in college. I mean, we were talking about The Sopranos earlier. Half of the fun of The Sopranos was hearing somebody call bullshit on all the political correctness.
Right.
Which was completely strangling our ability to even talk to each other. And humor is very touchy.
Sure.
You know, obviously, humor is like, you know, it's filled with stereotypes, and like racist humor is like something that always deserves a target on it. But then the more restricted you become, the more outrageous people are looking for in their racist
joke. Well, yeah,
you get someone like Sarah Silverman, who is saying the worst possible thing that she could possibly say. That's the joke. I love it.
Yes.
And I feel like people are up everybody's ass about it.
It's because, yes, it's sort of... because a lot of comedy is subverting power. So it's not that, you know, if Sarah makes a joke like that, she's not saying it like she literally means it. It's more of a commentary on we're not supposed to say these things. But that's part of what comedy does, is it goes after things that are taboo. And
right.
and always, and the history of communication, it's always been that way. It's subverting popular things or like what people are afraid to say.
But the punishment is worse than ever.
Well, I'm going to – did you read John Ronson's book on public shaming?
No.
There's a, the guy, this guy named John Ronson, and he wrote The Men Who Stare at Goats, and he wrote Frank, and he wrote... And he wrote a book that was all about...
All books I have been given and not read. Well, I probably have this.
You could start
Send it to me.
I will. He wrote a really amazing article for New York Times Magazine all about basically the witch hunts and the public shaming, where if someone makes a kind of inappropriate joke that they would make with their friends, and some of the jokes that you see are like, okay, yeah, that was really bad, but some of them... It's like, if people are hanging out and they sort of, because they think in this social media bubble, like, oh, I have no followers. And then something happens and then boom, boom. And then the entire world is like, you're the fuck you. You're worse than Hitler. And they lose their job. They lose their family. They lose that. Like, they lose everything.
Yeah.
Because people jump on the shame train.
The last person to take everything away from people for saying what they wanted to say was Hitler.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. There is definitely... I mean, there is legal free speech in the country. Like, you're not going to go to jail for anything.
Right.
But there is certainly socially.
I find and then there's the defensive posture from those people who are making the accusation, which is when they are saying it's your right to say that, then they will just say it's not funny.
Right.
And I have to say that is the scariest thing in the world to anyone who's trying to tell a joke, is to just have someone just tell you you're not funny. there's no defense for it. There's nothing you can say. You're like, oh, maybe I said it. Maybe it wasn't funny. It is the public shaming thing. I think it's a response to powerlessness. I think that there's like there's such a superiority complex among the people who write on the internet, which is not – the whole population.
Right.
It's a small bunch of people who, I don't know. I mean, I have to say that if I had, failed in many ways, I probably would be one of those people. You know what I mean? I could see. Seriously, I'm not saying that they're all failures.
You mean trolling? Like people who troll and shame?
The trolling and shaming thing is actually pathological. But the sort of like, I'm going to... It's the attitude of the tabloids a lot of times is one, it's a position of virtue.
Right.
It's like, can you believe this person would do this?
Well, I mean, it's the hypocrisy that everyone has shit. Everyone, like, if someone followed the average person around all week, recorded everything they said, you could pull out a lot of stuff and then you could crucify them for that if you took it out of context.
That's what the show is about.
Yeah.
That is really what I've been writing about all this time.
That's really interesting.
Like, yeah. It's sort of the idea of, like, these are regular people. And... I can't even say something like, you've never kept the change, mm-hmm. really. I will give you one of my moments of shame, which is that I had, and it will all make sense to you as like, I had our first child, he was 2 years old. We, my wife goes to yoga on Sunday morning. I was alone with him. I took him to the mall. We went to buy a birthday present for one of the billions of birthday parties that we used to go to at that age. Like, why are you doing that? The kids aren't even playing with each other. It's really just a chance for people to get skin cancer. So we're going to go to the park. So we go to a toy store. And when we leave, I get all the way down to the car in the Century City parking lot, mall. And there is a Curious George doll that he is holding in his hand.
Oh.
With the tags on it and everything. So I've stolen this.
Yes.
And he is sitting in a pile of crap because I haven't changed his diaper because I didn't want to change it in the store.
Of course.
And so I change the diaper and then I look at the time and I just leave.
Okay.
Now, if he was old enough to know what was going on, I would have gone back there and made a lesson of it, I guess, on some level. But I stole this doll.
Wow.
Okay, right? No one's ever done anything like this. When I tell this story to parents, it may be like a pack of Rolaids in the supermarket. You never know what it is. Almost every parent has been in this situation and been like, you know what? I'm not going back up there.
Right.
So next time I go there, I'll buy one of their other overpriced Discovery Store the store's not there anymore. And I don't know what the statute of limitations is, but I don't have the doll anymore. I think we actually
That's all
away.
We need to buy. So they come to the
No, but I mean, it's like a terrible thing. So here I am being completely honest about this aspect of human behavior. And a lot of people are going to be like, that guy's a piece of shit. I can't believe that guy fucking did that.
Right.
What an immoral person. His kids are going to be criminals. He's a criminal. And I'm just sitting there saying like, it's like you go to the dentist – and they say, do you eat candy? And you're like, yeah. And they're like, when? I'm like, I don't know, when I go to the movies. you know?
Yeah.
We're already in a lying zone there. Like, candy is like the second biggest business in the United States, like, after, like, meth or, and weed or whatever.
Right.
It's, like, huge, right? And I'm like, when I go to the movies, what do you eat? I'm like, red vines. I get red vines. You eat the whole box? I'm like, sometimes. You might as well just give yourself a sugar bath. Do you floss afterwards? Do you brush in the movie theater? No. I can't. Well, you know what? You're going to get what
you... What are you, flossing with red vines?
You know, he's like, you're going to get what you expect. And I'm sitting there saying, like, do people come into the dentist office and tell them that they don't eat candy?
Oh, right. Of course.
Who's eating it?
No, never have. No, I've just always...
Who's
I'm
eating
just better
candy,
than everyone
right?
else.
Yeah, what do you do on... Oh, I just have one once in a while.
I think
I'm like,
the public shaming thing is such a problem because it... I mean, there are some people who are...
I think people are lying to themselves, is my
point.
Yeah,
of course. So
I remember people used to complain about the swearing on The Sopranos. They're like, I can't watch it. It's too much swearing. And I was like, I don't know. I went to an all-boys school. I think it's about normal. I wasn't allowed to swear like that.
Is that
but
really
I do believe people...
Yeah.
I know, and that's the worst thing, you know. And then you watch just the culturally, you know. I remember them showing a clip on these... There was a movie award show, and they showed a clip from Pulp Fiction, where and I'm friends with him. I went to high school with Phil Lamar.
Uh-huh.
Phil Lamar's in the backseat of the car, and they hit a bump, and the gun goes off, and he blows his brains all over the back thing. So they show this clip, but they bleep out them saying, "Oh fuck, oh shit."
Yeah,
and I was like, "What culture do we live in where you can't say fuck, but you can show someone's brains all over the back of the window?"
Oh yeah, it's weird. It's so strange, and I think, you know, I think that's why one of the reasons why to England why we look so crazy. It's like, wait, you're gonna flip out over a nipple, but you can show someone's guts in their hands?
Know,
like, are you kidding me?
I know.
So you know, like, we get caught because there. I think most people.
I told Charlie Collier when I saw the pilot. Someone we both know, the head of AMC.
Yeah.
When I saw the pilot for The Walking Dead, I saw it at the premiere, and I was like, "This is going to be a very successful experience for you guys." And I go, "Why?" And I go, "Because people are really angry right now. They are filled with murder, and they can't do anything about it. And you have just given them a scenario in which it is okay to shoot a child, even because there is in the pilot. Remember, there's a guy he didn't like that much at work who comes to the fence who's kind of and he's turned into a zombie. What are you gonna do? You gotta blow his brains out. And I felt like it was like a wish fulfillment of like acceptable violence. You know, my wife is out there. She's a zombie. I don't want to kill her, but she hasn't been acting right, and she's gonna kill me. And it looks like her, it sounds like her, except for the right
that part.
Right, and she used to do her makeup better than that. Although that is really good makeup.
I don't see the toilet paper's not on the hair. But I think you know this. The thing that you just said about acceptable aggression or acceptable violence. I think that's where the shaming comes in. Is that I think it's you know one part. I have pent up rage that I have to follow these strict cultural rules the rest of the time. Ah, here's an outlet for my rage.
Right.
Here's an outlet for my unrelated rage.
Right. And but there are people who deny that they have rage. You understand that.
Well, but a happy person doesn't just dogpile. Like, a reasonable person goes...
Who is happy?
Well, I guess no one.
Do you know what I mean? No, I mean, it's like, it's great. It's great, you know? I have experienced moments of happiness. I experience happiness a lot, actually. I just don't know what the natural state of a human being is. Just like on, like, just take your limbic system or something like that.
Right.
Like the reason why you can respond, you know, there'll be someone will, you know, drop a pen behind you, and you don't think that it's 9/11. You're just like you're supposed to be on guard at all times in case somebody's coming to eat you.
Right.
You know,
right.
I mean, we are in a mode of survival. It's why you know when you're like laying in bed with your wife or with your children or your lover, or whatever you are like in a vulnerable state, let's say, of like feeling those feelings. And then when you get up in the morning and you get dressed and you get in your car, you're in a different state. The idea that we are and by the way, I think looking on your phone to be entertained or to keep up with what's going on, that is always – you're always looking for entertainment.
Yeah.
You're always looking for a diversion of some kind.
People are constantly distracting themselves, which is why I think time seems to be moving so fast because you're distracted at all times.
Yeah.
And so you're not noticing the passage of time, and it's like, well, now it's already the middle of 2015.
The mindfulness thing that people are talking about, which I think is amazing, and there's always, like, whenever there's a technological, like, boom like we've just had with, like, massive change, there are transcendental meditation movements, believe it or not, to slow the mind down and to pay attention to things. It happened in the 20s, happened again in the 50s. It happened in the 70s,
yeah.
And it's happening right now. Probably happened somewhere in between there. But a lot of it is about, like, I am addicted to stimulation. This is more stimulation than I've ever had. What was my mind like when it was at rest? Why can't I control the chatter in my head? What is that about? And then you put the phone in there, and you don't even know what's you and what's it. And there's so much pleasure. You are pressing. It's literally like sitting at a blackjack table. You're sitting and pressing a button in your brain. And I am, like, not judging it, because I am one of the worst people in the world about this.
Of course.
And I didn't have a smartphone forever because I knew I couldn't handle it. I have seriously, I didn't have it till like 2011 or 12. Everybody else had it. I didn't want that 24-hour a day, like, why haven't you answered my shit? Because I get nervous about unanswered shit. And I am also super impulsive, so I have a bad temper. So, like, oh my God, I'm going to write one of these emails and I'm going to send it. And then I'm going to be like, why didn't I just sleep on it? You know? But, and also, as you know, people use this to cross boundaries. And I think the anonymity of it, part of me, everyone says, don't even think about it because there's so much stuff on there that nobody takes it seriously anyway.
Right.
Which I don't believe. And then, you know, when you're a creative person, like, you know this, you're in a conversation that you are on you're giving the gift. I'm saying this about you. You are doing so much entertainment right now. It's almost all comedy, or it's trying to be comedy.
Yeah.
I'm going to be I'm not being generous. It's really funny. It is a diversion. You're introducing us to funny people. You're telling us shit we don't know about. You're talking about stuff that comes and goes. You're talking about our entertainment. And no matter what, the minute you go on the internet, you're going to be on the defensive. Right? Like, why what is that about?
For the most part, but I also...
do you feel like it's the same as getting on stage when you're doing stand-up?
No.
Because there's people paid to be there, and they're kind of interested in laughing, and right?
You know, a little bit. I mean, just because it's a little similar, because the percentage of people that give me shit online, like, it's about the same. Like,
you read it all, right? People are coming out now.
As much of it as possible.
Yeah, I know. I read it too. I used to actually try not to read it. And then I would get together with showrunners and found out that everybody, even though they said they weren't reading it, was reading it. And now at least people are coming out admitting that they read it.
Yeah, I mean, because I think there is still some value in it as long as you can. I mean, if you get out of this mindset that you have to have 100% success rate, like, you don't, you can pass with a B. You know what I mean? Like, I think what you got to do is take the most toxic stuff and the stuff that praises you the most and sort of push those off to the sides and look at the middle, because that's where people are having the least emotional conversation.
But I think most of us cut everything off except for the bottom.
Yeah, because, you know, because that taps into the insecurities that we have, and we're like,
they made you who you are.
They see us. Oh my God, they see what a fraud I am. And so, but you know, the problem with using it as a distraction to stop the chatter is that it's a self sustaining mechanism, in that it silences the chatter, but it creates more chatter to deal with when you put it down. It's sort of like how, you know, when I used to drink, a lot of the drinking, I think, was to try to quell anxiety. But in the long term, drinking creates more anxiety.
Right.
And so then you have to drink more. So it's the same with this. It's like, it silences the chatter in the moment, but the long-term effect is that it creates more chatter. Because
right.
when you put it down, you're like, why'd that guy say that? Or what did that person mean? Or, oh,
right.
I need to do this. And
right.
so then you could keep going back and keep
right.
going back and keep going back.
Right.
It does.
No, I mean, look, criticism predates the internet.
Of course.
And there's lots of great artists who have had, you know, a lot of problems with critics and don't like being criticized. No one likes being criticized. And people sort of, like, wannabes a lot of times end up in that field, or they cut themselves into your creative experience by commenting on it or whatever. They you know, you kind of want to say, like, you do it or whatever. And at the same time, I took an attitude from the beginning. I couldn't believe that there was a Mad Men blog. I couldn't believe that, you know, that people were that into it, and that they treated them like real characters. The only time that I really get frustrated with it is when people start talking about what the show owes them.
Sure.
As a fan. And like, what is their satisfaction level from watching it? Especially because it's being written while they're watching it.
I'm right.
Like, you don't know what the satisfaction level is, first of all. And I am, you know, you got to dance with the one that brung you. Like, I, you know, it's part of the peculiar nature of Mad Men is that it's not for everybody. But
right.
I want it to be for everybody, but I want all the episodes to be different. And so I sort of get in this thing where I'm kind of like, well, you know, I remember reading all these. I had sworn off of it and read, and then The Suitcase aired, and people who knew me, who knew I wasn't reading anything on the internet, gave me my first hit for free that I hadn't had in a long time, and like sent me these incredible things that people wrote about the episode. So then, of course, I'm like, well, you know, there's that. And so the next week, the episode that I thought was the best episode of that season aired, called The Summer Man, and I go and read it, and it is just like brutal.
Yeah.
And then, you know, now they do these rankings of the best episodes of the show. Like, you know, I did no athletics in my life. All rankings make me nervous anyway. All lists, everything. Like, you know, I'm a competitive person, but I really don't think about that. And that's like ranked as like one of the fan favorites, audience, what critics' favorites episodes is the Summer Man. This thing that I just remember saying like, well, why were they so nice last week? And this one's better. And like, oh, I was heard and then I wasn't heard. And you're just like, you are doing this for an audience. Who knows what the audience is? It's not just the people writing on the internet.
Right.
But we're in, you know, having the critical conversation and having the fact that you can at work go on and read a blog about Mad Men, you know, the day after you saw it and mm-hmm. see what other people thought about it and see hear people's insight or their personal experiences with it or even just a recap so you get to watch the episode before your boss runs back over just by right. reading about it. All that is like amazing.
But it's also essential because, you know, some shows people just watch. And other shows build communities, and other shows build a subculture, you know? And
I think that every show has a subculture now.
Most of them do.
I think it takes a while for it to happen sometimes.
Right.
But I think that the fact that that these Netflix shows go on and they're available for 24 hours and you see like these massive chat rooms about them, like how fast did these people watch it?
Fast.
Right. And then they're writing about it like within, if it's a 13 hours of or 10 hours of programming from like 10 yeah. hours and 15 minutes afterwards, there will be 1,000 people commenting on
it. Well, and last night was a particularly insane astrological alignment of Game of Thrones, Mad Men, Good Wife, Silicon Valley. Daredevil just came out
Daredevil was the one I was talking about that I couldn't believe how much conversation there already was and people had to watch it when it go on Friday.
I've already watched 4 episodes.
Yeah, but people have already watched all of them. Yeah.
That happens in video games too, where a video game will come out and it's a game that can have like 30 or 40 hours of gameplay on a Friday and then by Sunday people are like, I beat it. And you're like, what?
How could that be? I play stupid crap like Candy Crush and stuff and I look and see where these people are on it and I'm like, I don't know if it's – and it's not just they're spending money on it. They are just that much better at it than you are. That's amazing.
I don't know. No matter what, there's someone who has more time and is better at something no matter what it is. But I really do think that Good Stuff, Bad Stuff is all part of the community and the conversation. And that's why I think it's very important to take out the most emotional responses because – a lot of times the really emotional responses say more about the person who wrote those than, I mean, listen, I'm not for everyone either. And I know that not everyone likes what I do. I don't have a problem if someone says like, I didn't like this or I didn't like this. But if someone goes, you're a fucking piece of shit. And I hope, I hope a horse fucks your face to death. Then I'm kind of like, well, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with that. Like, that's not really, you just wanted to say a shitty thing.
Right.
So I can't. There's nothing I can do with that. And then you go...
why did I buy that horse? And what am I going to do with it?
Had the biggest dick. to fuck my face to death. So, but now, like, I don't block people anymore, even if they're negative, because I feel like it's important that I don't build this cocoon where I've made myself comfortable that everyone likes what I do. You know,
but like, what about people who sort of like accuse you of a crime that you didn't commit that you can't respond to? Like they assert that you are in an almost. There are people who assert stuff that is almost like to me. Tinfoil hat kind of thinking
well, yes.
of it. So, no. I mean, it's not as extreme as that, where they say things like, you're trolling us. You know what you're doing. The reason he did this is blah. And I love people with crazy theories and stuff. I was an English major. I have a very good argument for why Blue Velvet and The Graduate are the same movie. You know, I have no problems with critical
thoughts. Kyle wants
critical
to
thoughts.
Know. Kyle wants to know.
Just think of it. Just think about it a little bit. Seriously. I like that kind of stuff, but there are people who are just like, you are, let's put it this way. I don't know if people are just using the word symbol or symbolism wrong, but I don't deal in symbolism.
Right.
I'm not interested in symbolism. It's not one of the tools of my writing. I believe in foreshadowing, and I believe in planting and payoff. And I believe in self-reference the way people do in life. Like, you know, there's a lot of ironic conversations in our life, you know. You're going to – you run into someone who has just bought a horse later today, you're going to laugh about this conversation. And if we were in a show and we heard that you make that joke, we would laugh with you.
I'm not going to laugh if I get fucked to death in the face by that horse.
No.
It would be difficult to laugh. I'll have a horse stick in my mouth.
But you know what I mean? And so there's this sort of suggestion that you have some kind of diabolical plan to fuck with them. Like you're the one with the superiority complex when you are just in the entertainment. Well, you're just trying to tell a story.
So let me ask you this, because this is a little bit different than – because a lot of times people – I feel like we're in the middle of this thing that I'm calling the apocryphips, which is basically people with no information – tell you or tell other people what's going on when they have no information.
That is very true.
All the time people go, you did this because of this. And I'm like, that's not. Here's four other reasons why this happened.
Know.
But I'm curious, as someone who's creating a work of fiction, which is a little more open to interpretation.
I love interpretation. That's why I mentioned the Graduate Blue Velvet thing. I don't have a problem
with
that.
And by the way, before the end of the podcast, I'm going to get you to give me the nuts and bolts of that idea. But before we get there, where do you think the truth lies? You as the creator of Mad Men or a writer on Sopranos, or you create what you believe is a truth about these characters. If most of the other people who watch that get a different truth, what is true?
You can't do anything about that.
So it doesn't matter
that
to
could
you.
That could be – A, it's fascinating. B, sometimes it means you've succeeded beyond your intentions.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's something where you're like, oh – maybe that was on my mind and I didn't realize it,
mm-hmm.
You know? There are all kinds of things where someone, you know, I try not to repeat things unless it's on purpose. And having a reference is different than having a symbol. But, you know, like you're saying, sometimes it's out of nowhere. Well, obviously, the steward spilled red wine. Thanks for the obvious symbolism. It's obviously blood on the floor and we're supposed to be freaked out. And I was like, no. In my mind, Don had this whole thing with Megan about that white carpeting, and we know she decorated the apartment, and now he just brought in this girl, this stewardess to have sex with her, you know, his third choice for the night, and she ruined the carpet.
Yeah.
That's what that was for me, and he doesn't care. That's what that is. Is it symbolic in some way? I mean, spilling wine is symbolic, I guess, for, you know... There's, you know, certainly if you're a reggae fan.
Sometimes spilled wine is just spilled wine.
Sometimes it's usually, you know.
And thank you for the UB40 reference.
You're welcome. You're welcome. That's red wine.
Yeah. Oh, that's
but red. Who does spill the wine?
Oh, that's war.
Yeah. There you
yeah.
go. Okay,
yeah.
So.
Yeah.
This is fun time travel. So, I don't have any control over what they take away from it. And like you're saying, a lot of times it's what's there for them. When Betty Draper's father was suffering from dementia and grabbed her boob, because he thought it was his wife, that was a story that I had heard about many times in my family about someone who had actually turned out Alzheimer's.
Yeah, my dad's father, who died from – who suffered from that in his later years – my cousin would go in and he would get – like he would kind of like hit on her and try to – because he didn't know
where – exactly. They were riding on the bus or something like that. I'd heard the story. So the amount of people – and this is before like full-fledged like, you know, 50 recaps the next day. the amount of people that came up to me and said Betty was molested by her father, wasn't she? And I was like, no, but what are you bringing to this?
Right.
Do you know what I mean? I don't, that was inappropriate behavior. And the reason why Don didn't punch him, why didn't Don punch him in the face? Why didn't Don ask her why, when she was molested? Does Don know she was molested? Is he going to molest Sally when he lives with them? I was like, he is, I don't know how to explain this to you, but obviously this is not part of your experience, that this is a medical thing that goes along with, unfortunately, losing your mind.
Yeah.
So certain social graces are become warped, whatever. So you're, yeah, they got it wrong.
Well, but
but did they get it wrong? I don't know. I mean, it makes me worried when I like go and do this whole, you know, what I think is a very touching and reminiscent of my childhood, this relationship that Sally has with her grandfather, where he was, my grandfather was like this for me, where he was just like, he totally made me feel like all the craziness in my family was normal and that I was special and he spent a lot of time with me, and then he died. And that was the story I was interested in telling. So when people were like, so the molester finally got it and she's still crying because she's protecting him, I'm just like, this is like built on something that I really didn't mean that.
It's a little bit of a Rorschach test with art.
That's what I'm saying. It's like I can't control that, but you're really wrong.
Yeah.
You're really, really wrong. And this is not part of your experience. What is part of your experience? I'm not going to argue with you about that. I can't.
Yeah. But I think it's the blessing and the curse of good writing and having really complex characters is that people sort of become conditioned to go, oh, there must be, you know, like, I mean, because especially when you go back into the past and you see Don Draper like watching, like looking through the hole and watching,
right.
Watching,
you know,
prostitutes. Yeah.
Here's another thing that's just socialized. That when you go to the flashback to that whorehouse where he grew up and that woman seduces him, that's rape.
Yeah.
If it was a guy the same age as that prostitute and a girl the same age as Dick Whitman, you would know that that was rape.
Yeah.
And the kid keeps saying no, and he says he doesn't want it and he doesn't like it. And there was so much conversation about his first time and him losing his virginity and Don, you know,
but it was abuse.
Like it's absolutely abuse. I mean, why do you think the guy's behaving that way?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That's not, you know, don't think that everybody wants to be in that situation. We all like, certainly boys have sexual feelings inappropriately towards women who are much older than them. It doesn't mean that they want to act on it.
Right.
And it doesn't matter because the whole issue is consent. And it's not just a legal definition, but when you're under a certain age, consent is consent.
Right.
When you don't want to do something, children have to do so much shit that they don't want to do anyway. And when you put sex into that, you are basically, you can fuck them up for the rest of their life.
Right. And the other thing is that this whole idea of what's okay to talk about in that time period and the idea of the sort of keeping up appearances where it's a period of time where people don't – where therapy isn't like
– I know.
It's like only crazy people go to therapy.
Or rich people.
You deal with your own problems. Like you don't really have any problems.
Right.
You just suck it up and go to work and shut up. And,
especially men, yeah.
Yeah. I mean –
what do you think a bartender's for?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know, like my dad's father, the one who had dementia, you know, he was a very cold guy to the family, but in his mind he was like, I put food on the table, they have a roof.
Yeah.
What's the fucking problem?
Exactly.
You know, like
exactly.
there was no let's talk about our feelings.
Yeah.
Like there was no
I know. When I was selling the show, that was one of their issues. They're like, Don needs a Melfi. You know, and Dr. Melfi.
That was a product of that time period, though.
That was what the great conceit of The Sopranos was, is that this guy is going to a psychiatrist that's insane, right?
Yeah.
I mean, not to use the word wrong, but that's like incredible that a mob boss would go and that he has psychological problems and he's going to go on Prozac or something. I said to them, I was like, this is the whole point. It's exactly that, is he doesn't have anybody to talk to. And you will see him be much more open with strangers because of that. You will see him find a place to work the stuff out, and then you will see him living with a lot of this on his own and just bearing it. And just that's what the silence is about. That's why you never know what they're thinking. I mean, the power, if anything else, it was dramatically a lesson for me because you wouldn't think it would work. And it depends on someone having someone as amazing as John Hamm to perform it.
Yep.
But the power in not talking that Don Draper has in keeping his own counsel and just letting it work out and letting people like you and me who abhor silence and are anxious just like tip every aspect of our hand.
Yeah.
And that those guys were, they, a lot of them, that's that you grow up in that family as a child. I mean, I've never seen my father cry. Let's be more specific. Have you?
My dad was a crier. Yeah.
Oh, he was.
My dad would cry.
Oh.
My dad would cry at like an insurance commercial. You know, like you'd see some sad, you know, what are you going to do if when your loved ones?
That's who I am.
Like, like my dad would just be sobbing openly. He was a crier.
That's what my kids have to deal with.
But that's why that scene was so great when Don Draper's actual, like the first Don Draper wife.
Yeah.
Like when that happens and then he melts down on the phone and you're like, whoa, he doesn't. Because really good shows, one of the stars of the shows, the invisible star of the show is the environment.
Right.
You know, like
yes.
with Breaking Bad, it's this family. Right. You know, like this teacher, this family. With Walking Dead, it's the apocalypse. With Mad Men, it's this place where everyone's constrained because they can't have conversations about shit they're going through.
Right.
And so it forces them to behave in ways like the environment is a star of the show.
That's why I'm wondering about these limited series about coming back, you know, and because I'm thinking about what I'm going to do next and I'm working on a bunch of things. But I always wonder, like, isn't it coming back to that environment? Like, almost as important as like, and let's take the two top things.
Yeah.
You want good writing, you want good acting, you want all this stuff, but it's the actors who play the characters and the environment that they're in. And the idea that you would like lose that after 10 episodes and go back to the same place. I don't know. I'm curious how that's going to work.
Yeah. You mean like with True Detective or with.
Yeah.
Like,
or like, yeah. I loved Fargo. And I kind of, you know, I hate to sound like that guy. They probably all heard it. I'm sure they can pull it off again. But I wish that I could spend more time with those people.
Well, because it's very...
And it's going to be a prequel like 20 years with all different actors and, you know, in the same environment, but a new case and everything. And I'm kind of like, am I being that audience member that I hate? But I love... You know, everybody's had the experience of being sick and watching 5 episodes of a sitcom that you've never seen.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, it doesn't take that long. You may burn out on it quickly, but it doesn't take that long. You will basically get attached to any show that you watch 5 or 6 episodes of, don't you think?
I absolutely think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's also – a lot of times it's a magic number. I mean, there are some shows where just the first episode you're like, okay, I'm in. Like
right.
Mad Men is one of those shows where like within a minute you're like, oh my God, I love it. Pregnant people smoking and drinking. You know, but there are other shows where – you're like, oh, you know, I'm going to hang in there and see how it goes. And if you make it to 4 or 5 episodes, then you're in. Even if you recognize the show isn't great,
right.
You're like, I'm already emotionally invested. I'm just going to see where it goes. You know, I've had those shows.
When I'm working, I don't have that time to do that. And I know like a show like Seinfeld, I didn't watch it till like season 3.
Yep.
And then I watched everything. You know, I have to be talked into it. And now that there's so much new stuff, I've gotten to the point where it's like reading scripts to me where I'm like, you know what? You get 2. If you get 2, life is – and if I don't like the first 2, then I need somebody to come up and like, you know, evangelically make me watch the next ones. And actually, you know what? Sopranos, I've said this before in public, but I didn't like the pilot that much. Not because it wasn't good, but I just was like – I have a thing about people laughing when they're torturing other people.
Yeah.
I'm not that sensitive, obviously.
Right.
I've written some violence in my life, but there was something about when they were getting rid of the body and how it was kind of cool and stuff like that. I was like, I don't know if I want to deal with this right now.
You didn't buy it?
No, I just like, it's like, there's a lot of these scenes often in Quentin's movies also where it's like someone's in dire straits and the other person is using it as an opportunity of tension to basically, they're going to torture them by talking to them and then they're going to kill them.
Right.
And there was and it's a sort of like lighthearted, it was big thing in the 80s actually, when I was coming up, like, or 90s, right when I was out of film school, where it was just like brutal people who thought it was like lots of laughs while you're shooting somebody in the head.
Like Shane Black kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. But more realistic. It got more and more realistic. The only time I've ever seen it really done, well, The Sopranos did it amazingly, but, you know, whatever. And it was new, which is hard. So anyway, so I didn't watch the second episode. I had a job. And then my wife was watching it. My wife was hooked right away. And then the college episode came on, she's like, you have to watch this show.
And that's what got you
and
in.
That, and I watched the episode, and I talked through the entire thing to her. I was like, do you know what's going on here? Do you know how amazing this is? Do you know that the main character is going to kill somebody with his bare hands? Oh, my God, the guy has kids. They're breaking every rule that's ever been established in network TV. I cannot believe that this guy's doing this. And she's like, what did I tell? And then you get to the end of that episode when Tony's waiting outside for his daughter to go to her college interview. Do you remember this episode at all?
Kind of. It's been years.
The first thing, it is the best episode of the show because it's the first one that even came close to that. You know, I mean, they're all good. The Sopranos is, you know, I tell people when they're like, I haven't seen The Sopranos. I'm like, there's a Beatles album that you've never heard.
Right.
Just go and watch the first season of The Sopranos. It's going to blow your mind how much it's related to your life, how exquisitely made it is, how great the cast is, how funny it is. But anyway, that
I owned
episode,
it on VHS, by the way. I had the first season on VHS. That's when I watched The Sopranos.
And so that basically Meadows, they're driving in the car on the way to her college tour. And she basically says, I know what you do.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
I've tried to do things like that in Mad Men when I could. And, you know, I remember coming back in season 5 when Don, you know, had proposed to Megan at the end of season 4, which was, I think we were off the air for all this time. We come back and she does the Zooby Zooby Zoo dance for him. And she comes into his, into the bedroom afterwards and she says, oh, nobody loves Dick Whitman. And because you think that's going to be the tension is he, right. It's going to be exactly what it was. And I remember someone said to me, to my face afterwards, exactly what I felt when I watched that Sopranos episode. She knows who he is. What's left to tell? What's the story going to be? How are you going to have a story? And I was like, that commitment to like, I have another story for you.
Right.
That's the kind of thing that the Sopranos would do all the time, like over and over and over again. And I know, I don't want to sound weird about it because I know I was part of the show and I wrote on the Sopranos and everything and you mentioned it, whatever, but it's hard to explain my relationship with it because I wrote on a sitcom for the first 4 years that it was on the air. I mean, I've been in sitcom all that time. And I still, like, mentally don't sometimes, especially those seasons that I didn't work on, don't see myself as part of the show at all. So I feel perfectly capable in saying it's the greatest thing ever. You know, and I mean, my joke was always like, people are like, what's the difference between, you know, writing in a sitcom and writing on The Sopranos? I'm like, it's the exact same job. I sit in a room with a bunch of writers all day talking about The Sopranos.
Yeah.
And we were just obsessed with it. We were. That was like, you know, all we talked about. Everything was. I worked on the last show I worked on before I got my job on The Sopranos. I was working on Andy Richter Controls the Universe.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And we had to cast Andy's maid. My episode was this thing where Andy had a maid who was like just ripping him off because he's such a good guy. And they're like, she should be really hot. And we cast Lola Glaudini, who played the agent, one of the agents that compromised Adriana. Do you remember Adriana was like found out by the feds and they were like, she had that friend. And actually, Lola Glaudini's husband was played by Will Arnett.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Which is like, yeah, he was great. And he was the FBI agent. So we got Lola Glaudini to come in and do this, and she was such a huge celebrity to all the writers and Andy Richter were like, what's it like on The Sopranos? Like, and all the questions that people ask about Mad Men sometimes, like, are they drinking real liquor? Like, what's Jim Gandolfini like? Like, how long do you have to shoot it? Do they put your nail? Are those your nails? You know, just like, there's a bunch of guys sitting around asking this woman, this gorgeous woman, these questions. So it has a status to me of just always being about in some way. First of all, it's a goal to shoot towards, to have that relationship with the culture, to have that relationship with an audience, to constantly be original, to write about the substance of real life, you know, so that your expectations about entertainment are actually 90% of what's making it tense.
Yeah.
Right? And we try to do that on Mad Men too, where that's where I talk about like fans talking about what you owe them. I'm like, If you know what I'm doing, then don't watch the show because you already know what I'm doing. Unless you enjoy seeing something you've already seen, which I do understand. I kind of get that too sometimes as a fan of like Agatha Christie and like, you know, whatever comic book movies or anything like that. You're like, you kind of James Bond, Like, if you don't Sherlock Holmes, like, if you don't get, if you don't get that moment in the Agatha Christie where they pull everybody into the study and, like, and then he and he puts on a clinic of how everybody, if you don't get that, you're kind of like, well, that was fucked up. That was the shittiest Agatha Christie I've ever seen. Right? I remember, isn't there the one where they all did it, like the Orient Express? Where it turns out every suspect was involved.
Was involved in some way.
Spoiler alert. 12 people.
That's a funny sentence. This fucking Agatha. This is the shittiest Agatha Christie story I've ever.
Right.
What a bitch.
I cannot believe that you fucked the franchise like this.
You have a brand, Agatha.
Yeah.
You just jumped the. Why don't you draw yourself jumping a shark? Right about that.
Yeah. In a wicker wheelchair.
But I think it's it's seven seasons, right? Mad Men seven seasons.
It's seven seasons,
but sort of drawn
but
out.
Told out over 50 years.
was it 9 years or 8 years stretched out?
Well, the actors will tell you that it's 9 years because we shot the pilot a full year before we went into production.
Okay.
So, but and there's like. You know, so there's a year between it, but we were actually on the air for 8 years.
Wow, that's really
insane.
'Cause there's
16 months off in the middle of the whole thing.
Yeah,
like 14 months or something like that. 12, I don't know, 12.
So the idea,
like a full year, there was a full year between seasons at one point.
How much do you think the public is addicted to crazy reveals and things that can't be spoiled? Like, because when people go,
I have a very different concept of that. There's so little. You know, I mean, because like the show just premiered in Great Britain and they don't have any dealings with me and the show already aired here. They've all seen it. There's no screener necessary or anything like that. And they just write the entire plot of the episode in the review. And I was like, I don't want that. I really don't. It's happening on such a small scale that I feel like to, like, yeah, you could sum it up in, like, three sentences. And by the way, it's wrong half the time, too. You're just like, wow, that's not what happened. Like, it's not it's subject to interpretation what happens sometimes. In any show, in The Walking Dead, it is. It's like, he did it because he had been embarrassed. Like, you don't know that he was embarrassed. I did not see that. He did it because he did it,
right?
So I feel like The Sopranos was where I learned about this. And like Tony got shot in the premiere of second to last season. That's another thing where they have like season six of The Sopranos, or I think is split into two halves. Mm-hmm. It's really 6A and B or whatever, but it's really two seasons. It's like 12 episodes and eight.
Okay.
And I remember like, don't tell anybody because it's going to be amazing to see Tony get shot because it comes out of nowhere. And you have this experience, and you can watch it a second time once you know what it is, you know? I watched the show. I was just talking beforehand about watching it with my 14-year-old, watching The Sopranos. He's finally watching The Sopranos. Not like finally. I finally let him watch The Sopranos. Like,
well, you have to suck it up. It'll be
come
fine.
On.
Stop crying.
Yeah, so the spoiler alert, at the end of season two, when Janice and, you know Richie Aprile's going to get killed. They've decided they got to get rid of him. They decided he's in the way. Tony sees him as a threat, et cetera. And then Janice is cooking his dinner and he punches her in the face. And you're just like, what? He punches her in the mouth. And then he's like, then he taunts her and she shoots him in the chest and then calls Tony. And it's an amazing episode, first of all. It is just like watching it with my kids again and knowing what's going to happen and seeing them react to it. And I was like, I called David Chase and I was like, that shit holds up. Let me tell you something. Because they actually went, oh my God, out loud. And you just want to preserve the surprise. Is like you got three tools in your toolbox when you're in entertainment, and you know you got mystery, you got suspense, and you have surprise, and that's it. I count laughter as surprise. You know, you go to a movie and see the trailer. And you see all the best jokes in the movie, you go and see it, and are you like, oh, yeah, there's that joke I enjoyed. You know, it's not as funny the second time,
right.
Correct? So I wanted to preserve that as a mode of entertainment. And then it's not that everybody has to do it, but then you sort of get this thing, well, like, no one's going to watch it if they don't know what's going to happen. I'm like, just let me deliver once. Let them watch the pilot. And January Jones, this like incredibly sexy movie star like presence, right, is going to appear at the end of this as his wife, but I'm not going to let her promote the show because I don't want anyone to know he's married.
Mm-hmm.
I want them to watch that first episode and just be like, what? Right? And it was part of how I sold the pilot. It was a new story for the hero. As much as Tony strangling that guy, it was breaking a lot of rules of entertainment to have that man that we were following and loving and wasn't a racist and, you know, he's a bit of a sexist, whatever, but see hit that his our virtuous hero who turns down his secretary is actually been cheating on his wife the whole time. So that was worth delivering on. You know, I delivered on that for people to come back the next week. And so I kind of feel like, you know, I don't want people to know. And then, you know, as the internet came up, knowing how much time had passed became an issue. Because it would be in the review, an article of everything that was going to happen that year. In the first season of the show, Wikipedia existed, but like I had people coming up to me asking me like, well, who wins that Nixon Kennedy election? And I was like, and I was kind of like stunned. I was like, well, really? History? And they're like, well, I know Nixon was the president and I know Kennedy was the president. I don't know who won that election. And I was like, okay, that makes sense. You've now revealed how dumb and uninformed you are. And I want to know where you went to school. And I want to tell your parents that you don't know that.
That was before Kennedy needed the wig. Come on, guys.
Oh,
a callback.
That's an hour away. Nicely done.
Bringing it all. Yeah. But how important do you think it is for all of our...
Now I know that you can edit this. I have to tell you my joke while we're in the moment. Okay. The joke I would always say, are you aware of the fact that both the Bewitched pilot and JFK were shot in November of 1963?
Why would you have edited that out? That's a great joke.
Oh, it's tasteless.
Well, no, because JFK was replaced by Dick Sargent. That's right. The original president got shot, and so they just put Dick Sargent in as JFK. Like, no one would notice. I almost feel like today they would have tried to explain it with magic. Like, oh, he regenerated or something happened and Samantha cast
it. I remember that, wanting to recast somebody at some point. I will not get any deeper into it than that. And just saying, like, I grew up, my mother watched soap operas in the afternoon. They would just, like, have a new person come in or have the same person come back in another wig.
Right.
Like, the audience doesn't care. They're just like, you know, if it depends on what it is. You know, you can recast them if you have to. And, you know, so I obviously do believe that, or I wouldn't have had so much recasting in my life.
Why do you think it's so important?
I mean, don't you think this about the spoiler thing, or you think I'm crazy?
No, it's just that I think people I think people get mad at spoilers the way they used to get mad at, like, apartheid. You know what I mean? Like, where people are like, don't fucking, you better not. Like, people get so aggressive about it because I feel like there are so few surprises in our culture. And people just get so, like, don't you take that away from me. I need this so bad.
But it doesn't bother me. But that's happened during the life of my show because I've been on the defensive about it the entire time. Where I've literally had critics come up to me and say, nobody cares. Nobody cares about your show. Nobody gives a fuck about what's going to happen on there. Just tell people, or we have nothing to promote. Why would I review your show when I can't say this, 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 and this? I was like, I don't know. I mean, you don't have to say you like it.
Well, it doesn't change the –
I feel like for us, it was commercially like a niche to say like, okay, I guarantee you that even though the show is about regular people and you sort of like, you know, they're walking around on the Titanic talking about how safe it is, you know, you do know what happens.
Sure.
You do know what happens because you live in 2015. You know exactly what happens.
Yeah.
Let's take that out of it for a second. I might do a story about, you know, somebody eating somebody's apple out of a refrigerator at work. If I tell you that, you know, that ends with somebody getting fired – why watch it?
Right.
You know, I've taken like the delight out of it to me. The delight is how we tell the story.
It is, but it's not, but there's a journey, you know, like, so, you know, with Game of Thrones last year, there was a major character death that was spoiled because people assume I watch everything the second it happens.
Oh, right.
And it, but it didn't, you know, I was like, oh man, oh well, but that's not the only reason I watch Game of Thrones or watch Mad Men is to be so surprised.
You know what's weird is that I've seen a bunch of movies recently that are based on true stories where I don't know the story. And this has happened to me a couple times. And my wife knows the story, and my kids know the story, but I don't even know it's made up. You know, like wild. Like yeah. I didn't know. I just assumed that that woman was going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to tell you something. That's a very different movie if you don't know that she survives it to write the book.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was very tense for me. And I thought it was going to be like Into the Wild, quite honestly, because yeah. of the title. Or like, what was the one where I was just like, you got to be kidding me. Oh, the
Marley and Me?
You know what? Nobody knew that's what that movie was about. You got to admit, that was a movie too where I was like, oh, it's so dumb. It's a guy and his dog. And all of a sudden I was like, what the fuck? I don't want to watch this.
Yeah, I don't think my dad, that movie, I'm not sure my dad was able to get
I don't think anyone can handle that movie. Yeah. But no, you got to admit, nobody knew, I guess, if you read the book.
Maybe, yeah.
No, it was The Perfect Storm.
Okay. Oh.
I had no idea that that ended badly. And I was like sort of watching it and I was like, and it's George Clooney, you know what I mean? Yeah. I was just like, there's, and all of a sudden I was just like devastated. I was like, this is, oh my God, this is horrible. You know, I had the similar, this may be where my spoiler thing comes from. I had this similar experience when I was in high school. My car broke down. The family car that was like passed down from kid to kid to kid, was a Volvo. It wasn't a diesel, but it was like a, it was a Volvo that like could not go uphill.
Mm-hmm.
it was a wagon. And, at some point I found out in the '90s, these were chick magnets, not when I was in high school. This was the kind of car that when you leaned against it, the paint came, the oxidized paint came off on your clothes. So it broke down. I'm in Orange County. I'm by myself. I get the car towed, which is a huge pain in the ass before a cell phone. People don't even realize this. I flag someone down who calls a AAA. And I went to what do you do in Orange County? No one knows, but there's more movie theaters per like square foot in Orange County than like any mall in America. And so I went to the movies. And I walk in and see a movie that I know nothing about. And I am laughing. I am laughing. It's Poltergeist. And I got to tell you something. Craig Nelson was really funny. Joe Beth Williams. It's funny. The kids, you know, they're smoking dope at the beginning of it, the parents, and they're like in their housing community. And you think it's just sort of comment on like on Orange County, which is where I am. And all of a sudden that hand reached out of it. And I'm alone in the theater. That hand reaches out of the TV, and I have never been more scared of anything in my entire life. I like was like, what the fuck? And it just got scarier and scarier and scarier. The movie doesn't hold up?
No, effects don't hold. Like, the effects of the movie don't hold up.
The effects thing, we were just talking about this. Like, I showed my kids this the James Bond movie where the tarantula walks on his chest, and I remember, like, not wanting to sleep with the sheets around my neck.
Yeah.
And you watch it now and you can see the piece of plexiglass to the point that like there's fingerprints on it.
Well, the expectation thing
but
can
your
work...
childhood, I mean I was oh. like in, I was 15.
The expectation thing can work for and against you because I think it can work for you if it goes in a direction that is intriguing to you. But let's say you went to see Poltergeist and you're not a fan of horror movies. And then all of a sudden you're like, "What the fuck?" You know, like you need
I'm super open. I am super open. I got to say that right now. I realize now that this is a strength, but I do not have prejudice against almost any kind of entertainment, book, whatever else it is, speech, anything. I don't like hate directed at me, but I'll try anything. I will try anything. Well, I mean, I don't even know like what's the worst example of what I would watch, but before there was YouTube, you know, in comedy writers' rooms, all that would be was people bringing VHS tapes of like obscure things that were incredibly embarrassing most of the time. Whether it was like Linda McCartney being isolated, you know,
of course.
Like there's tons of this stuff now. There's a comedy writer named Tommy Blacha.
I know Tommy.
Yeah, okay, so Tommy is like one of the funniest people in the world and the king of this shit.
Yeah,
and to the point where it's like he's, you know, I just remember him one time talking about Mario Lanza, and I'm like, well, what about Mario Lanza? And he just looked at me, he's like, you don't know about Mario Lanza? Not like, I can't believe you don't know it, but you're just about, I'm jealous that you don't know about it, because you're just about to hear the most amazing thing that you ever heard.
And then he plays it.
He just told me the story of Mario Lanza. They didn't have a tape of it or anything like that, but Mario Lanza had a weight problem and was really kind of a despicable person on many levels, but had like the most incredible voice. Like Caruso was like, how could this voice, this angelic voice come out of this piece of crap? Right. And one of the things was, is he was constantly fighting his weight, and his manager would put him, I think people still do this actually. It sounds good. I don't, I'm not suggesting this is not for the people at home. Do not, not try
not
this.
For general consumption.
Yes. They would put you in a twilight sleep, which is they would drug him for like 30 days in a hospital bed. And he would wake up and he would have lost like 30 pounds.
Oh my God.
So guess what? One time he died. So Tommy had some like cartoon character based on Mario Lanza. But, you know, just like, or like look well. Or like
it's funny that we can laugh. It's funny that we can laugh hysterically, and like, and then he died. I mean,
it sounds like the stupidest thing in the world to do.
And hey, surprise! Oh, okay. So we shouldn't do. Okay, we shouldn't do this.
Yes,
it's gonna be interesting to see if you, if your next project is.
As his manager said, he became unavailable
for a while. But it's gonna be interesting to see if you jump into one of these things where it's just like, I'll just do a mini series just to bang it out. You know,
I'm gonna try not to be too precious about. It. There's so much pressure. I mean, I don't expect to have this experience again. First of all, I never can because it's the first thing that ever happened to me. So I don't. You'll never have it anyway. But I think that you can get into a mindset. We're talking all about what people think and where it comes from. And I'm not going to write about this. It was one of the things that I said. Like the second season of the show, I'm like, we are not writing about the show. I don't want to see it in the show. I don't want any reference to like the success or what or anything that anybody's saying about the show. We can write about how we feel about the show, but don't write about the show. So I'm not going to necessarily turn this experience. I don't see myself writing a sitcom about a guy who has a basic cable TV show.
Right.
But I am like, you know, looking forward to, if I cannot get that precious about it, to doing a number of things. I'm working on a bunch of things at once right now. And I just sort of got the yen to go back to work.
Yeah.
Which is weird because I'm talking so much about the show ending. And you know what? Bryan Cranston said something about this when Breaking Bad was ending. I was like, what is it like? You know, you've lived through death. What's it like? And he's like, you know, it was over a long time. It's kind of a weird thing to like, you're dredging up these feelings. He goes, you're not faking it, but it's been over for a while. So like part of me is like, I don't want to feel that again. And part of me is like, you got to be there for everybody else when they're feeling it, if they're attached to it.
Sure.
And when you're the showrunner, it's like more times than anybody, but everybody's going to experience on May 17th, the last show. Everybody who likes the show or had anything to do with the show is going to experience it going away. Last original episode, whatever. So for me, like getting to the place where I deal with my anxiety by writing. It's one of the luckiest things that ever happened. By writing and getting rejected for my writing. That's really how I've dealt with my anxiety in my life.
On some level, whether on a network level chat thread.
Exactly.
Level,
it's like sort somewhere. Of like it's sort of like an expectation.
You seek it out.
I take a stand.
Yeah.
And I think I have, I don't see it as a style or anything like that, but it's not, I'd like to think it's for everybody, but I've been told it's not. And that's a lot of times why it's been, you know, why it took 7 years to get it on the air. But my interest in like what I find entertaining or what I want to see, or that has been an interesting thing to like, just think about the form differently. Just think about the miniseries and like, think about like multi-camera sitcom, like what happened to that? I can't even explain to people. Like, you know, growing up, there was Happy Days, which was a multi-camera sitcom, All in the Family. Mm-hmm. This is in my youth, like real youth. Like, I didn't even understand what the fuck was going on in All in the Family. I had to like catch up with it later on, and MASH. So this is comedy and then Mary Tyler Moore, right? Multi-camera, MASH, not multi-camera, single camera. You know, All in the Family, I think, on video with a live audience. Mary Tyler Moore on film. You know, these...
Newhart film,
right? So you're watching these things and your experience of it is like, well, what happened to that? I can't even tell you how related to life and how meaningful those shows were. It's got to be a cycle, right?
Maybe, but I think it's also... I mean, it's going.
They're still watching Lucy.
They are, but it is. I think it does go back to the element of surprise, and you know, surprise is a dangerous tool in the tool bag because it is very satisfying, but it's also a limited resource. You can't.
That's exactly it. That is very wise.
The more you surprise people, the
it takes more to surprise them. That's why I have not become addicted to it. That's why living in a spoiler phobic universe, my surprises can be on the level of like, oh my God, where are my car keys?
Yeah. Well, and that's why I think.
Your wife has them. That, oh my God.
That's why I think.
I've never ever had the show had to function in that way.
Yeah, because when.
To outrageousness.
When it does, and it's like, by the time season 7 happens,
you're in preposterousness.
Like people, yeah, exactly. People are like, someone came in with a shotgun and they
blew
up.
People are mad
the-
at you if they don't do it.
Yeah.
You know, I kept talking to, especially in the art department, like, you know, we have a unique situation that Dan Bishop did the first episode after the pilot and was there. He's a production designer the entire time. Janie Bryant, the same way. Chris Manley started season 2. That's the same thing. He became a director on the show also, cinematographer. To keep those people in the same job, you don't just have to be nice and pay them well. They don't want to get bored.
Right.
And at a certain point, I'm like, we're coming into a kind of extreme period in American style. We can't get mannerist. Mm-hmm. We can't, like, overdo it. We can't, like, start, you know, reveling in how, like, weird it is. Regular people, I can show you pictures of people in, like, 1980 in suburban America, and there are still flat tops and plaid shirts and khaki pants.
Right.
It just, like, took a long time for that to go away everywhere. And so you can't just like run into this because you're bored with what you're doing.
Right.
So if your goal is to imitate real life, which it doesn't have to be. So I'm always impressed. What it usually means on a long running show is new characters.
Mm-hmm.
People have babies. That was traditionally a thing. Yep. Like there's a new kid and he'll be born 1 year and then he'll be like talking like he'll be like seven the next season.
That was growing pains.
Yeah. A lot of them.
Yeah.
A lot of them are like that. Or if you can find a kid who looks really young. I think Game of Thrones has been really interesting because you watch that first season of that show and you're like, it was one of those things where it was like, for me, very exciting to see them commit to a story that basically like, you better have more story.
Right.
You got rid of both those guys in the same scene.
Yeah.
I'm just like impressed with that.
But the fundamental mechanism of that show is you... That you know what the goal is mm-hmm. through the entire series. Everyone wants to take over the realm. And so you're watching this chess game. And so you know, you always know. You
right.
don't know you don't know specifically what everyone wants. You don't know how they're going to go about it.
Right.
But you know it's all about how do I get that fucking Iron Throne. Like
right.
that's what everyone's trying to get. So it's just watching everyone sort of go about
See,
that.
On Mad Men, everyone... wants the Iron Throne, but what I'm always interested in is why.
What is the Iron Throne in Mad Men?
I think it's, you know, the life that was promised in the ads. Life on TV. Like, I want
the idyllic.
The idyllic, whatever that expectation is that we have. All Mad Men is about, to me, is about a bunch of people like us who are living in an environment where our expectations are based on fiction
mm-hmm.
and on a cultural fiction that we've all agreed upon. And when I, you know, when you talk about like, is Don, it in America in particular, the heroic myth is always a myth. You know, we were talking about this the other day. I think it's like some inordinate number, like more than half or close to half of the presidents of the United States were raised by a single mom.
Oh wow!
Yeah. So our concept of like what it means to be grow up and be president of the United States, it requires having the right family and what, you know, it's not that person necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
So Don Draper looks like the ultimate white guy, but he is from rural poverty and from an evangelical background and, you know, went AWOL during the war because he had a self-preservation instinct and is capable of transforming and lying to people into whoever he is and is a very moral person, except for it's completely situational, which makes you the most immoral in a way. So I like look at what does Don want? You know, Don, when Betty finds out who Don is, I mean, yeah, he's cheated on her, lots of stuff. There's many reasons. But why is that the ultimate insult to her? It's because she married someone who she thought was of a certain class.
That's what, okay, good. So I was, okay.
To me. Yeah. To me. Okay. That's another one that's open to interpretation.
That's the one I thought too, is that she realized he wasn't this like super suave blue blood kind of a guy. And yeah. She was like, oh, you're garbage.
Yeah.
And that, and this idea in her
he
head.
He is white trash.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's fun if you're playing Lady Chatterley, but I don't think it's fun if you want to live in a,
and then she goes
house.
And then she goes and marries another blue blood dude.
Yeah. Exactly.
So that's,
and those rich people, someone was saying this to me today, like they behaved in a way that we all tried to emulate, whatever we perceived them to be. They were well read, they were charitable, they were patronizing in every aspect, but it's like not the attitude of like, you know, look at how many cars I have.
Right.
And I'm not saying there weren't people like that, but it's not really what it is. And it's in Gatsby, which was the last time we had an economic boom like that. You know, that's about the 20s. I always feel like the show, you know, you take Joan in the pilot telling Peggy, like, here's what you're going to strive for. And you see Joan, you know, she married a doctor. She, like, quit her job. She's a single mother at this point. Like, is that what you expected to have? How is that related to her life, right?
Right.
She had that baby who it's not her husband's baby. This is, by the way, this is another story that a lot of people came up to me and they're like, that's what happened. That's what happened with my mother. She, or whatever. Not mine, but people would tell me the story like, my mother had a lover and they couldn't get divorced. And so, like, blah, 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 blah. And you're like, what? How did you find that out when she died? Because it was so shameful. God. So, but I just sort of look at like, what are we told to expect? And it's not like there's some force like inventing this bullshit thing. We all agree that's the way we would like to be. Who is that person that has the life that we want? And America, a lot of it has to do with transforming your class, you know, with starting and, you know, with the Horatio Alger or whatever the bootstrap story is. But I do think that Don Draper in particular, the hardest thing for him when he got divorced the first time was admitting that he had like gotten all the way there and pulled his whole life together and just could not stick with it.
No.
And could not keep it together. And why is he trying to feed that need? You know, what is the bad feelings that he has about himself that he needs to pursue strangers all the time? I don't know, but it makes him good at advertising. So I mean, you know, but I feel like that the why part of it is not always, every show does not have to deliver on that, but for us that's what the show is about. Why?
I, by the way, just as a fun joke, it would have been funny if Joan's kid just had silver hair, and it was,
I know, never... he does have white hair, like, little kid. I know, we were like, what could we do? I know, he's like,
I mean, not every, you know, I don't think everything needs to be answered when a series it ends, but I do think,
Let's just say right now, nobody wants their entire like 92 hours, 7 years of the show to be judged by the last 5 minutes of the show.
Right.
I just think it's sad. That's a sad thing. And
but you know, people do that.
Everyone should survive it. I don't know if they really do, because I've never seen anything so unjustly shit on as Lost. And it's coming back around now as people are discovering it again. The pleasure that people had for years and years of being told a story that they'd never heard before.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I was a huge Lost fan. And I think for me, part of the confusion was the show was about science and mystery and conspiracy, and then in the last season it became more about good and evil and spirituality. And so
are they supposed to do? They got to change, you know.
I still love the show.
Once you get over 100 episodes, like, you know, you try and think of, unless you want to see the same thing over and over and over again.
I just think that sometimes, you know, like,
I was on The Sopranos when all people would say, you know, the entire time I was there was like, not that I had ruined it, because they knew I wasn't, but they were like, when's somebody going to get whacked?
Right.
Like, when's Tony going to fucking kill somebody? Enough with the dreams. Like, nothing happened last night. And I was like,
a lot of stuff happened.
They go, it wasn't real. And I'm like, none of it's real. Just so you know.
Well, I just think, you know, there is an interesting challenge, because some doors that are opened, people are like, why were those doors open? And then yeah. Other doors, you're sort of like, ah, I get that. I didn't need that one. And you never really know until, because right. People are going to decide whatever those are. So
the Russian was this like on The Sopranos. That was just like an incredible frustration for people. And I just watched Pine Barrens with my kids. And, you know, definitely one of the, along with the masturbation episode, and I think they probably happened around the same time, the astronauts of television. Those two episodes are just completely flew in the face of everything that had been done on TV. And, you know, they didn't. I said, "Do you want to know what happened to the Russian?" They're like, "No." I'm like, maybe if you were watching it every week instead of like, you know, 10 episodes a day, you might be ruminating in between episodes about what the hell happened to that guy. How could they not tell us? He got away. I mean, we saw it, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know what to tell you.
There's only
like, ambiguity is a tough thing because it is the refuge of scoundrels as well. I've been on shows where people are like, "Well, we'll just leave it open-ended." And I'm like, "But you know what happened."
But The Sopranos was pretty open-ended. Maybe it wasn't from your writer's
No, I do think that Sopranos is open-ended, but there are things within the realm. It wasn't open-ended because no one could decide what to do.
Right.
It wasn't like a cop-out for like where you're like, "I don't know. I don't want to take a stand." Let's just say life's just like that. Sometimes you don't know. That's not what it was. It was literally like certainly the ending of The Sopranos, and I get asked to talk about it all the time.
David Chase said some stuff about it a couple of years ago, right?
Yeah, a year ago or something. He it's his thing, and I loved it, and I've gone on record as saying I loved it, and I always feel like, you know, I always feel a little bit on the defensive when I get asked about it, but because it's like, I don't know what you want me to say. It's like been 10 years, and we're still talking about it, so obviously something was right.
Yeah, listen, if anyone is wondering about that,
and
just
it didn't undo the show.
No, just look up the interview that David Chase did a panel somewhere, and he was like, "Look, this and this and this," and it's out there if you want to see what it is. The only show I think that was unanimously ended perfectly was Newhart. The most perfect ending because
for that show
because it basically, you had to have watched the first series for it to have made sense.
It was a funny idea.
And it was just like, they stuck the landing on it, and that was it.
It was a huge joke.
Yeah.
That was great.
Because the show itself became very surreal. Like, the comedy on the show, in the beginning of the show, it was very much like, "I'm an innkeeper, it's crazy."
Oh, that show was really,
And then Newhart itself just, like, went way off the rails and got really surreal with Larry and the Darrells and all the craziness. Oh, yeah. And so to end it in a very, in that sort of way, like, it made the entire series make sense.
And Bob was so normal.
Yeah.
He's so great.
It's still amazing.
Yeah.
So as we're wrapping up here, first of all, hey, fucking congratulations on a huge,
thank you,
like on a show that's been one of the most important pop culture flags in the ground of television.
That's very flattering.
Influenced the way cable shows are made. Influenced styles. Brought us people like Ham and Christina and Elizabeth, like so many great performers, and then also, you know, like really taught us about like having continuing a conversation about a show, and pulled us into this world and into the subculture. It was just like
I hope that like whatever our conversation is here, it's like I don't get to participate in that conversation. That's my frustration.
I just hope
is my conversation.
I hope you take it as all 100% victory.
I can't believe it happened.
Yeah.
And I can't believe that someone comes up and says, "I'm Sally," or "I'm Don." And you never know who's going to say "I'm Don," by the way. It's not just men.
Yeah.
And their age varies very much. Don hit a nerve with people. I can't believe that I got to have this like experience of like, you know, and I work with so many people. It's like I in all of these conversations, but there are so many people's lives wrapped up in it. And I don't mean like, you know, oh, they were great to, you know, be along for the ride. I mean, who literally contributed storylines and personal things from their lives and got all the details right. And, you know, there's props in the show because it's of a period that are like belong to people's grandparents.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. There's so much personal shit in the show. I can't even tell you, like not just mine, everybody's. So, and that, by the way, was very fulfilling because I would get to hear everybody's stories and I'm a junkie for that shit anyway. But I've also gotten to hear the stories of a lot of strangers, and that if your goal is to create something so that other people don't feel alone and also you don't feel alone, then I feel like the luckiest person in the world. And I'm knocking on your wooden table here.
This is a solid wooden table.
You're like the luckiest person in the world. And what is that horse doing here?
No, it was foretold.
Oh my God. What would Quincy say? It was murder.
Quincy, you know what Quincy would say? At some point, Quincy would be like, wait a minute. I work in the morgue. Like, I shouldn't be out investigating crimes. Just like Chips would be like, we're highway patrolmen. We shouldn't be off the freeway investigating crimes. Just like Mannix would be like, what?
You and your...
Just like Dennis Weaver would be like, I'm a cowboy. I shouldn't be investigating crimes.
Oh, those rules. How could people not know when they saw Columbo walking up their driveway that they were done?
Yeah. The second
How
he
many
was like,
people think they're smarter than Columbo? Like season seven.
The nail in the fucking... Yeah.
How about... Even worse. How about... Angela Lansbury.
Oh, yeah. But
how would you not know? No. But has anyone been around so many murders in their life?
But you see, this is my theory on that. First of all, you know you're fucked if you hear Columbo. If Columbo's talking to you and you're like, please don't say just one more thing. Please don't say just one more thing. Like, you know, then you're fucked. But, you know, my longstanding theory on this podcast is that Angela Lansbury, that the character of Jessica Fletcher is the murderer.
That would make so much sense.
Of course it would.
Because she loves the attention.
Because, and I've said this before, but
all those innocent people.
That all of Murder, She Wrote, you're only if you're lucky, you'll never be around a murder in your life.
If you're lucky.
If you live in a small town in Maine and you're around, you know, 12
every
seasons
week,
times 20 episodes.
Every week someone gets killed.
Not counting the ones that Tom Bosley stepped in because she was doing something else. But but if you're around hundreds of murders, you're the fucking murderer unless you're a cop. And she, I think the entire series is her retelling the events because she was such a narcissist. Of putting the murders on other people, and she's writing this narcissistic memoir from prison, and that's the entire murder She Wrote. The fucking title tells you.
What is the ending of that show? What was the last episode? Did they ever reveal this?
I don't remember. I have to go back to my home planet now. And then
how do they like escalate that for their big ending?
I don't know, but
were they just like, hey, we're gonna do six murders this week because it's the last one.
If I ever became friends with Angela Lansbury, what I would do is convince her to shoot an Easter egg that you would tack on to last episode of her like putting the typewriter away in the jail cell and having the warden go, all right, Mrs. Fletcher, lights out. You know, of like her going, no, Dirk Benedict did it. You know, and she was like, no. but here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to run pee really fast, and then if you still have 5 minutes, yeah. I want you to tell your theory about Blue Velvet.
Oh, sure.
I'm just going to pee really fast. So,
okay. So this crackpot theory that I have is an English major theory.
Yes.
Which I wasn't, by the way. I was in some weird major that was philosophy, literature, and history mixed
together,
and it had no grades, which my father, as a professor, found to be hilarious. Well,
but, you know, how do you grade a philosophy paper?
They have no problems with that.
Oh, no, that's
but
true.
Yeah, they have no problems with it. Yeah, they had these comments where they would write down like way worse than getting a C. They would write like, you know, you never went to class or you were, you know,
your professor would prove you don't exist because you're
would say things like, you know, you don't have a serious attitude about this. You're, you know, you didn't show up, like all the things you want your parents want to read about your behavior. So, where if I just gotten a B, what's the difference?
I think you could freak out my philosophy professor and convince him that none of it exists, that all of his students are just extensions of his ego.
And then get off. You'd probably get an A. So anyway, my thought is that, you know, and Blue Velvet was very important when I, at least in the, not just in the entertainment community, to everybody, that movie came out and was really earth-shaking, especially at the height of the Reagan era, mm-hmm. you know, just to see a movie that had all of this kitsch in it and this sort of perverse sense of, it's a very dark movie. But the story about a young guy who is in Blue Velvet, in The Graduate, he's just left college. He's just graduated from college. In Blue Velvet, he's come home because his father's sick, who is basically exploring the dark side and getting involved with a woman. Let's say it's Isabella Rossellini. Let's say it's Anne Bancroft,
yeah.
who is in an inappropriate situation, who is dangerous and scary and older than him, and then having at the same time it happens to be, you know, the daughter, Catherine Ross, or Laura Dern, a more innocent, more appropriate person who's in the relationship, and getting pulled into this, committing the sin, and then getting pulled into that dark world and having to pay for that sin with the cost of your relationship with the girl who's appropriate for you.
Right.
And I always just felt like, as a coming-of-age story, that, you know, there's no Frank Booth in The Graduate, but there is the husband. You know, there is a reckoning for being with the wrong woman. You know, you're with another man's wife. That's what's going to happen. And in The Graduate, I mean, and in Blue Velvet, to me, it felt like the same sort of, like, a darker version, but the same sort of coming of age of getting involved in this adventure because you're exploring your carnal, darker side, and you're gonna, you know, are you in the end? Are you gonna end up with the age appropriate, sweet, virginal, whatever girl that you're supposed to be with?
So
do those seem similar to you at all?
I think they do seem very similar, and now I would like to see a David Lynch directed The Graduate.
I think it's why they resonated, quite honestly. I mean, Blue Velvet didn't exactly have like the culture like explosion that The Graduate had, but I think that they had a very similar influence for a bunch of people, certainly getting out of college or deciding what they're going to do, to sort of say like, okay, I want to be the regular guy in this world. I want to be the hero of the story, but I really shouldn't have been with that woman. Am I rescuing her? Is she rescuing me? And I'm, you know, and they're very different movies in every other way, but they are very similar stories.
This is an interesting thing because I have a theory that Tootsie and Titanic are the same movie.
Are you kidding?
Yes.
Oh, I was really interested. I'll tell you one thing. I mean, the story's good. Worth telling. It's worth telling over and over again.
Yeah. I mean, and again, it's not, you know.
I have a weird feeling that Iron Man and Iron Man 2 are similar.
He's still Iron Man.
I'm wondering if this Age of Ultron thing is going to be anything like that movie I saw called The Avengers.
No, it's different because Ultron wasn't really in Avengers, and so it's now
right,
he's
so
a different.
It's a totally different
thing.
Different movie.
Okay, good. But there really only are a handful of story mechanisms that you can tell.
Only a handful, but they can be told in very,
in
very,
very
different
ways.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
point of view is everything.
You know,
right?
One thing that I hear that's very consistent with shows that are really, really, really good and considered like the best shows on television. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, Mad Men, Seinfeld, Breaking Bad, whatever the show is. Game of Thrones is probably the only one because it's based on an existing work of fiction.
Right.
But it's hearing what you said where it's like people are bringing in real things that happen to them.
Oh, it's amazing.
And not like when you...
Sometimes they don't even know it's a story.
Right.
Sometimes they're just like, yeah, my grandmother, you know, oh my God, you know, she used to save her own urine because she was afraid that people would like, you know, use it for voodoo. And you're like, what?
It's too close to you to think
like,
that it's
anything.
Yeah,
you know how old people do that. I'm like, no, they don't.
That's
no, they don't.
We have to put that in it. Of course,
exactly.
That's a thing. Yeah, it's those nuggets. It's those little details that make it unique and special.
Sometimes
and authentic.
Two writers are together and they'll tell a story and someone goes, you can't have this.
Oh yeah,
use this.
What happens
this
with comics too?
Oh,
like,
sure.
Are you gonna? Because I'm not. And it gets a little muddy because
if you both witnessed it, what are you gonna do?
And if you're both tagging the joke, like whose joke was it? You know.
Oh yeah. It's my joke. I'm pretty sure.
You're the guest. You get
it's my joke.
If you want to use that horse fucking thing into one of your next things, you know what?
I think you have a record that you started that.
Yeah, I know. But you know, listen. If you want to,
but I am known for my work with horses. So
okay. Well, I'm just saying, if you want to make Hot to Trot 2,
I love that movie. I love that movie. Dabney Coleman, Cat Goldthwait. Those talking horses are fucking hilarious. I love that movie.
Dabney Coleman. Yeah.
And who was John Candy's the horse, right?
Was John Candy the horse in Hot to Trot?
Oh, yeah.
If you say
he
was, I believe you.
I'd be surprised. But that movie and Dabney Coleman, as always, the funniest thing of everything he
does. Fucking love Dabney Coleman.
Oh, my God.
Loved seeing him on Boardwalk. But I would just want, I want to see him do...
On Boardwalk, you wanted to see him just lose it.
I want to put him.
He's pretty scary.
He's really scary, but yeah. I want to put him back
in a comedy.
Speaking
of Tootsie, too.
Tootsie.
He was great in that.
He was fantastic in everything.
Yeah.
Fantastic in everything.
Yeah. Is it John Candy? I need to know, and then we can go.
I think you're right.
Can we put some money on it?
No, because I think
because you agree.
Right.
Oh, yeah. That's no fun. I'm not used to this whole agreeing thing.
How about, it is John
All
Candy.
All right. You can't beat it.
Can't
beat that. That is a movie that I would have bought if I could.
Oh, man.
I guess you can now.
Yeah, now you can.
Yeah.
Now you got to take that home. Now when you're showing your kids The Sopranos,
would love that movie.
You'll be like, your sorbet will be like, yeah, hot to try.
I know you guys like The Sopranos and all, and I know I made you watch Hiroshima Mon Amour, but let's.
But Hot to Trot is
really,
yeah.
Because I think it was the, you know, it really just changed the whole genre of the talking horse movie.
It really did. You know, before that,
because he had a family.
Yeah, Mr. Ed was just a weird drifter.
Mr. Ed
had a dark past.
Mr. Ed had a thing where you actually really thought that he was crazy. It wasn't really happening.
Oh, Wilbur did.
Yeah, because Mr. Ed didn't do shit, really. He just gave a lot of advice.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, did he?
I think so.
He embarrassed him occasionally.
That's similar to that comic strip that would take it's called Garfield Without Garfield.
Oh, yeah.
That these guys made a webcomic, and they basically just removed Garfield from all the panels, so John Arbuckle looks like a fucking lunatic. Just talking to himself, this sad weirdo talking to himself.
Garfield is an interesting thing. You got to be careful about who really likes it. I mean, Ziggy. Ziggy to me.
We just talked about Ziggy the other day. Ziggy was
the symbol of low self-esteem.
So just so sad. I always feel like Ziggy and Kathy would have gotten together, but in a very bad, codependent, shitty relationship.
Kathy, like, the world was rigged against her. Kathy had a sense of humor. Kathy was a pistol.
Yeah, but that's why...
Ziggy needs to be like... Ziggy needs, like, electronic convulsive therapy,
no,
like, 24 hours a day.
I know that Kathy has a low sense of...
Ziggy would kill himself, but he can't get a rope around that head.
But Kathy would have wanted someone to basically give her what she was not getting
Ziggy
in the workplace.
He didn't have a neck.
I know he didn't have a neck,
yeah.
But he was basically just face and butthole. Like that was his whole.
No, but wait, Kathy, the workplace. So what were you saying?
I'm saying she needed the validation, and how, like, he would have completely. They would have had such a fucked up codependent relationship.
Do you understand that Kathy used to say things like "ah"?
Yeah,
she used to explain, but Ziggy was never. He was
okay,
always
maybe,
like,
"Maybe
oh,
Kathy
the sun,
and you know what?
The sun set because I'm here."
Yeah, I think Kathy and Dilbert fucked in the copy room once,
oh, yeah,
but then never
true.
Spoke again. Ziggy was just a weird metaphysical being.
There is a woman who has There is a female character who has that kind of attitude about themselves. I can't remember. I used to read all of those things and just be puzzled because I realized, like, Mary Worth and all the really boring ones that adults were reading them.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is three frames at a time.
Yeah.
Like, what does it take? The girls in apartment 3G, like, what is going on?
Rex Morgan, MD.
Yeah, how
I don't
can
know.
You tell the difference? Who's what?
I have no idea. They all look the same. Serialized comic strips for adults.
That's why Gary Larson is so amazing. That shit just was like, I was like, oh, there's that. And I also loved all of the BC...
Yeah,
and Wizard of Id, yeah.
Bloom County was
Bloom,
Bloom
level.
County because Doonesbury was slightly too political for my brain.
I didn't know
when
who
I
the
was
people were in Doonesbury.
Bloom County was like Doonesbury for crazy people, and I loved it.
Bloom County was it's a different thing.
And I really
Doonesbury too smart.
Yeah, and it was also there was a little too much of a message to it, like. Bloom County was just fucking weird and just a weird comment. This character of Steve Dallas was so fucking funny to me.
Yeah.
And Bill
the
Cat and like all of it. I fucking loved it
my
so
roommate,
much.
My freshman year, was really into it and he had all the books. And I also loved Calvin and Hobbes.
Of course.
I mean, you can't.
It's a bit with a philosophy background, of course. Like,
yeah.
That's all
yeah,
philosophy.
Yeah, there was a lot of philosophy in there. But that tiger is not a real tiger. And I was disappointed.
That it was just all imagination.
That it was his imagination because I don't have one.
Yeah.
I told you, I don't like symbols. I don't like any of that stuff. I'm like, I want a real tiger. And I hate him for trolling us like that, for making us think that tiger was real. And then all of a sudden it's a doll.
That's a version of a way to upset your audience because you've taken them on a journey.
I know.
And you want it to be.
I want real tigers.
Because it's basically.
He owed it to me.
It's basically him saying, like, that's not real. Your friends aren't real. You're not real.
I know.
And
I
then
know.
That's why Calvin is acting up and peeing on the backs of all those cars I see driving around California.
He's the best. I wanted that hairdo, but it's too late.
You can still have it. Bring back the wig.
I'm going to bring
the
back
Calvin
the
wig.
Exactly.
All right. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you so much.
You.
As always,
so
a pleasure. Enjoy the rest
Congratulations.
Of your day.
Congratulations. Enjoy your burrito.
You.
Where's your book?
Oh, I didn't bring the book. Maybe you just signed a blank piece of paper, but I'm almost positive.
Just sign this thing made out to cash.
We'll add in this stuff later.
We'll fill it in later. Don't worry about it.
$1,000,005 million.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.